I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You're listening to the Inside Indonesia episode. For those of you who know Asia-Pacific, my guest this episode, Adam Schwarz, needs no introduction. He's founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors, a former journalist, a strategy consultant, and now runs his own firm. I sat down with him at the Conrad Hotel in Singapore, which looks out over the new sports stadium in the SunTech area. We were drinking Bloody Marys, and I started off by asking him about the early days, when he was at the Jakarta Post in the late 1980s.
I was working in New York on Wall Street in 1986, 1987, and I ran across a poster at Columbia University, where I had just finished getting an MBA, for a fellowship program from a foundation called the Henry Luce Foundation, which sends 15, or then sent 15 Americans abroad to Asia in various work placement opportunities across the region. And I decided that was an adventure that I didn't want to pass up on, or I thought I would go after. So I put in an application and went through a fairly lengthy interview process. But at some point in early 1987, I found out that I had been picked for one of these fellowships, and I ended up as a journalist in residence, so to speak, at the Jakarta Post in Indonesia.
So what knowledge did you have of Asia, of Indonesia, prior to arriving?
To be honest with you, shockingly little. It's one of the quirks of this particular fellowship program that they go after youngish Americans, mid late 20s, with having demonstrated some professional promise and competence, but not in Asia. So, for example, if you were an Asia studies major at college, or indeed even if you had traveled a great deal in Asia, you were disqualified. The thought behind this fellowship program is that if you were going to go to Asia anyway, you didn't need this fellowship program. They wanted to send a small group of professionally promising Americans to Asia for a year, get a sense of it, have Asia be a part of their lives, but essentially on the expectation that they would come back to the United States to work.
So in many ways, in the application process, Asian ignorance was a bonus.
It was a requirement.
Okay, great.
So then, and I qualified.
Well done. So then you arrived. You fly into Jakarta. You go to your new employer. That was the Jakarta Post. Tell us a little bit about that environment. What was it like? What was the setup? How many people? What was it? What you imagined from the movies? You know, kind of a backwater feel, or did it have a little bit of a modern edge to it?
Well, actually, it's an interesting story that happened just before I arrived. My assignment was actually to go work for the Malaysia Star, which was an afternoon paper in Malaysia. And somewhere around May or June of that year, 1987, the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, shut the newspaper down I don't exactly remember exactly what the infraction was, but for irritating the government somehow. And so my assignment disappeared. So we had to reconvene and figure out a new place to go. The foundation had actually never sent a journalist to Indonesia before, because it was an authoritarian regime. They were a little worried about journalists getting in trouble. But it was a little bit of an emergency situation, we decided to give it a try in Jakarta. I showed up at the Jakarta Post, and they had never had anybody like me, or they didn't have anybody like a foreigner show up and work there. It was a little newsroom in West Jakarta. It was no air conditioning. It was kind of working out of a shed. It was hot. You know, we were still back then working with manual typewriters. And I couldn't, because of the rules, I couldn't actually report on news. So the editor said, listen, basically you can do anything you want except essentially be a journalist. You could have been on the editing desk. After a while, they let me run the sports pages. So I was able to sort of correct the mascot names of U.S. sports teams and things like that. And after a month or so, they assigned me a restaurant review column, and I did try to protest, saying I don't really know a great deal about food. And the editor said, well, I didn't ask you to write about food. I just go write about restaurants. That'll be good enough. So I did that for a while. And then after about 2 months, the editor came by and he said, I want you to write the editorial for the paper tomorrow.
That's a big jump.
That's a big jump for someone who had was basically a beginning journalist and had never really written any commentary. And I looked at him, and he was a fairly formidable figure, and I was loath to say no, but I was really not wanting to say yes either. And I said, well, okay, but what's your opinion? What's the opinion of the paper that you want me to write about? And he goes, you do it. You go with the opinion.
And this is an opinion of anything?
Could be an opinion of anything. I said, well, that's what I said to him. I said, I can write about anything? He said, anything, as long as it doesn't have anything to do with Indonesia.
And tell us a little bit about the press freedoms at the time and the government that was in place.
Well, it was an authoritarian regime. It was headed by President Suharto. So this was 1987, 88 was the year that I was working at Jakarta Post. So he had already at that time been in power for 20 years. It was a very consolidated, fairly strong-handed authoritarian regime. And it was, you know, fascinating for me as an American. I had grown up in New York, and reading, you know, the New York Times was the newspaper on our breakfast table every day, and having a view of the media as, and of course, maybe 30 years on, we no longer look at the media that way in America, but back then we sort of looked at it as a independent source of views and news and an enterprise that was attempting to write about the truth, was attempting to get at what actually happened and not have that view colored by politics or by the opinions of the owners of the papers. There was sort of a clear distinction between the news pages and the opinion pages, okay, or the op-ed page.
So the paper was subject to censorship laws, and you had to be careful about where you tread and what you all wrote about.
Absolutely. So this was a big eye-opener for me to realize that separation between the news pages and the opinion pages didn't exist in an authoritarian regime. They were the same thing. I remember early on, there was an Indonesian small aircraft manufacturing plant called IPTN, which was headed by the research and technology minister, a very colorful character called B.J. Habibie, who many years later became president shortly after President Suharto was pushed out of power in 1998. Anyway, he was very proud of this facility, and he wanted Indonesia to be able to make high-tech products. So they made some small planes, and they made some helicopters. Anyway, one day, one of these helicopters crashed in the Jakarta Bay within sight of the city. So there were photos. And this required an all-hands discussion in the newsroom about what to do with this, about how much trouble they would get in to write a story about, because this was obviously embarrassing for Indonesia that its helicopters crashed into the bay. After a long back and forth, the compromise solution was we would not write a news story about it, but we would just publish a picture of it in the hope that just the fact of the picture would be able to dodge the bullet.
No caption.
Caption was something like, the scene in Jakarta Bay yesterday.
It's just for the record.
For the record. Yeah. But very clearly, because the markings of the helicopter were still on the fuselage, sticking out of the water. Yeah. Anyway, so we published it, and everyone the next day is kind of nervously twiddling their thumbs. Sure enough, this minister calls the chief editor, and by the volume of the conversation, the entire newsroom could hear it. And he was just completely chewing out the editor for publishing and damaging Indonesia, embarrassing Indonesia. And that was sort of an early lesson for me that even facts are political. Mm-hmm. Even stuff that you cannot deny with your own two eyes is political. It's part of a political narrative. And you know, you have to then rethink your whole notion of what media and journalism and what it does.
Yeah. So when you saw this occurrence and you were being asked to write
for the editorial page, opinion pieces. How did that shape what you covered, and how did you navigate those waters?
Well, actually, that was the easiest part to do, because my mandate was not to say anything about Indonesia. Yeah. So,
but still, there would be this idea of innuendo, or, you know, as some of the other papers do, they'll talk about other countries and their issues almost as a reference to their own market. There have been methods of using journalism or journalistic reference or to other markets or other situations to make a point.
That's true. I didn't actually take as full of advantage of that as I could have. I had just previously been, prior to moving to Asia, I'd lived in Argentina for a couple of years, and then I was in business school and School of International Public Affairs at Columbia, and I had done a lot of writing about, of course, what at the time was the Latin American debt crisis. The Plaza Accord and James Baker's then Secretary of Treasury James Baker and what he was doing in that field in somewhat of a critical vein. And the irony at the time was then so I wrote a series of editorials about that, kind of Wall Street sort of imposing its will on Latin American countries. Till one day, the point where the American embassy in Jakarta called the editor of the Jakarta Post to complain, saying, like, where's all this coming from?
Right. A young guy who's just come over from New York.
Yeah. And of course, the editor, having heard this, was pleased as punch. And he said, I don't know what you're doing or what you're writing about. I don't really understand them, but I want you to keep writing those editorials.
You're getting a reaction. That's good.
You're getting a reaction. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And then how long did you do that, Adam, before you went on? You then, you know, this was the birth of your career as a journalist, but then you stayed and wrote and moved into other publications as well.
That's right. So that went on about a year. The Loose Scholar Foundation grant went for 10 months. So I did that for 10 months. So, the middle of 1988, which actually was very good timing, because it was just when Indonesia was coming out of a very difficult economic period. It had become very dependent on natural resources. Again, interesting parallel with Indonesia in the early 2000s. But in the 1980s, Indonesia had sort of, you know, oil and gas had risen to something like 80% of exports. It had become very dependent on oil and gas after the two OPEC oil shocks in the 70s. And then when the price of a barrel of oil went down to almost $10 in 1986, Indonesia was in big trouble. So they then launched a big economic reform program, and they tried to help out and give incentives to labor-intensive manufacturing, to basically try to build a non-oil and gas economy, and did so quite successfully. So for the first time really since, probably almost 20 years, there was an interesting economic story in Indonesia, which until that point had been largely around politics, around ethnic or territorial issues like East Timor and things like that.
Yeah, so your timing was impeccable.
Yeah. Timing was fantastic. So I was there as it happened. I came from a business background. I'd had an MBA. I'd worked on Wall Street. Most of my writing at what little there was at the Jakarta Post had been around economic issues. Just at the time when I'd learned how to speak Indonesian. So just at a time where there was actually now an interesting story on the economic side, I was there in good shape. And so it was also a time when you had a first wave of a whole bunch of investment from what we used to call the newly industrializing economy. So where we used to have a lot of this labor-intensive manufacturing was in Taiwan, South Korea, and Hong Kong. By the late 80s, labor rates had started to go up. And so you had this big migration of that capital down to Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines. And Indonesia got a big chunk of it. So it became an interesting story to write about.
All right. So there was plenty of material. And at that point, is that when the Far Eastern Economic Review picked you up?
That's right. So until then, Farish Naganarayu had a single correspondent in Jakarta, again, largely writing about politics and security issues. But they added a second correspondent, which was me, to write about economics.
Yeah, and let's talk about the as it was known as FEAR. For it was around for many years, ultimately owned before it was sold off by Dow Jones. But it was really one of the most authoritative magazines on political economic events in Asia of anything that's been before or after.
That's correct. It was founded in 1945 in Hong Kong, right after World War II, and it was, you know, some people don't like this analogy, but I sort of liken it to The Economist, but just for Asia. It covered economics, it covered business, it had an arts and culture section, it had a travel section, it did book reviews. Mm-hmm. It pretty much was, it covered the same ground as The Economist did, with two differences. One, it was only Asia, not globally. And two, it was a writer's magazine as opposed to an editor's magazine. So my view anyway of The Economist is it's very heavily edited. About 70% of that magazine gets written in London. And obviously, they take input from the field, whereas the Review was gave a lot more rope to their correspondents on the ground, and the articles were bylined.
Mm. And being that kind of publication, it also had its moments of running afoul of governments in the region.
It certainly did. Now, it probably would have been true whether it was bylined or not. It's really more the kind of the editorial approach that the owners and the editors took, which was, you know, we're gonna tell it like it is. There was an ethos to the magazine that we're not trying to get kicked out of countries, but it is our job, and we're going to define our job as to get as close to writing about what happened as we believe it to be the case. So, you know, it was interesting for me, you know, again, coming from, you know, New York and the U.S. and having an idea of free press and something that doesn't get you in trouble, but get, you know, is something that's quite celebrated, to working in areas and regimes where this was not a welcome thing. And part of my life, it was, you know, constantly dealing with ministries of interior, ministries of home affairs, ministries of information, in a constant kind of cat and mouse type ordeal to shape what you do.
But at the end of the day, you needed to hold true to the story, to the facts, the information, and if anything, it was a decision by the editors to either run or not run with it.
That's right. So, my goal all along, I did not see losing my visa. I did not see, in a sense, getting kicked out of a country as a victory. What I saw as victory, what I saw as success, was staying as long as you can, staying, you know, right around that line as best you can, to get closer to that line than anybody else. But if you're not there, you can't write the story. And there are good stories to be written. And the longer you're there, the more you know, the more you can get at that truth. But you can't get at it if you're not there. Mm. I over the years in Indonesia, back in those days, I was able to cover quite a lot of ground, whether it was the secessionist movements in Papua or East Timor or Aceh, which are three provinces of Indonesia, all of which had secessionist movements going along. I was able to write about corruption to a certain amount, particularly President Suharto's children. I was able to write about some of the crony business deals that got done. I felt like I could get pretty good to it. And I'll be very honest, I think one of the key success factors that I had was that year of working at the Jakarta Post. In other words, being inside the Indonesian media and seeing how they saw things and where the words they used to be able to say, I'm using this word, but everybody understands it to mean something else, or where they could see where that line is. I learned a great deal about how to in that year about how to tiptoe up to the line and not go over it.
And you were reassigned to other places around Asia, but at the end of the day, you came back. And for 30 years now, you've been observing, commenting, engaging in Indonesia. What are some of your thoughts on how the country has evolved, some of your hopes and aspirations for it going forward?
Well, and in the end, I did have to leave Indonesia. I wrote an article in early 1992 about Suharto's children, not so much about how each of them had kind of built up a business empire and often in somewhat what we would define as in corrupt ways, but how the collection of these children had become a political issue. There were elections in Indonesia, even though it was an authoritarian regime, and even though it wasn't that hard to figure out what the results of those elections were going to be. But nevertheless, Suharto felt that to protect himself from foreign criticism, it was useful to have elections. So they did every 5 years. At any rate, they felt that that article was interfering in domestic political affairs. So they did take my license away, which in hindsight probably was a good thing, because it then gave me, I had a bit of time on my hands. I went off and I wrote a book on Indonesia called The Nation in Waiting, which if I had just gone directly onto my next journalism assignment, I probably never would have written.
And did you return at that time to Washington, D.C.? Is that did you go and teach at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies later?
No, I had a couple of different journalism assignments. I went back to Hong Kong briefly, which is where the editing was, and then I went to Thailand as our environmental correspondent. I had written while I was in Indonesia a number of articles about the forestry industry in Indonesia, which is enormous, and that got me very interested in the environmental climate change conversation. And I covered the Earth Summit in Rio for the Forest Nectar Review in 1992. But what happened was we had sent somebody to be our correspondent in Vietnam, and they didn't let him in, so they sent me in. So then I basically had to go from to use the sort of Jean Kirkpatrick distinction, a right-wing authoritarian regime to a left-wing totalitarian regime. And actually, it was a fascinating experience for me, because I figured it'd be pretty much the same. I mean, for me, the common denominator was these were non-democratic and they didn't like the free press. Which was true, but it turned out that they were very different. So in Indonesia, they basically, you know, and this is maybe typical of authoritarian regimes, they don't want you to sort of get in their their political space, right? But otherwise, you know, you do what you do, right? When you cause trouble, they come looking for you, right? The totalitarian regime and Vietnam in the early 90s was still a pretty strongly communist totalitarian regime.
This was before normalization with the U.S. in what, 95?
That happened in 95, and I went in 94. And normalization was either 95 or 96. There was a big ceremony in 95, which was the 20th anniversary right. of the Americans leaving. Maybe it was 95. But the totalitarian was very different. So I literally remember quite strong. My very first day in Vietnam, I got summoned to the foreign ministry. I met with the head of the Information Bureau, who sat me down and said, "Listen, I'm going to be quite honest with you. We don't like you. We don't want you here. And the only reason you're here is because the World Bank and others have told us that we're not going to get any foreign investment unless we let a few foreign journalists in."
So welcome to our country.
And I said, "Well, thank you very much. Nice to be here, too." So, and it was full on. It was, I had to hire an assistant from the foreign ministry to work in my office. She had, every Saturday morning, she had to go down to the Ministry of Interior and report who I talked to, who came to the office.
And you knew this, you were aware of this?
Yeah, well, because she told me. You know, there's not too many secrets. So, but I had somebody following me all the time, and they intercepted my mail, and it was very clear they were listening in. They would go down to my house when I wasn't there and have a look around. They weren't pretending to have any nuance. Let's put it that way.
It didn't end well, if I recall.
And then ultimately, they decided that I was not helping to get foreign investment in.
So if hard pressed to choose between right wing versus left wing totalitarian governments, you'd go with the right wing.
If you twisted my arm and said which one you're gonna have, I'm going right wing.
This is Inside Asia. More from my guest Adam Schwarz in one moment. This is Steve Stein, and my guest is Adam Schwarz, former journalist and strategy consultant, now founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors. Let's get back to our conversation. I asked Adam to talk about the challenges faced by Indonesia as it transitioned away from authoritarian leadership to a somewhat liberal democracy.
They spoke democracy as a second language. They didn't, you know, they could use the words, but they didn't really get it. They didn't really trust the results of elections because in their whole lives, elections were manipulated. They didn't really trust what they read in the newspapers because in their whole lives, they were right not to trust what they read in the newspapers. And so they didn't have any kind of confidence about, you know, about what their mandate actually meant. Whereas the current guy, Jokowi, I think he feels much more strongly he has a mandate. His challenge is that, you know, democracy, you know, one way that people distinguish authoritarian regimes and democracies is one between the rule of a person and the rule of a system or a rule of institutions or a rule of law. And Indonesia has been actually not very good in the last 18 years of building the institutions of democracy. And so trying to operate a democracy without those institutions is an extraordinarily difficult thing, and that's exactly what Jokowi is up against.
So he'll come out with policy positions, statements, plans and ambitions, but then handing them down to the various ministries, they're simply not equipped to then deliver on the promise?
That's a common problem he has. So let me give you an example. Until very recently, there's been no such thing as a sort of a chief of staff for the president. There's no West Wing, to use a U.S. example, because in the past, you know, authoritarians do tend to run a little bit by fear. So when the authoritarian says something, people do it. Right. And you know, people don't really ask and say, is that legal or do we need the right paper? They just do it.
There's not all that clever conversation and quipping going on back and forth between, you know, highly educated individuals as to shall we or shall we not perform in keeping with the president's requirements.
There's none of that. There's none of that. And, you know, so there's no principles committee. There's no coordination, right? There's no National Security Council. There's no National Economic Council. The way it worked under Suharto is that he had three coordinating ministers, probably a better way to put it. One for economics, one for political security, and one for social affairs. Now, these ministries that these coordinating ministers headed, they had no legal mandate. They had no budget. They had no resources. But what they did have is they were headed by three people seemed to be very close to Suharto. Yeah. And so when they called for a meeting, people showed up. When they needed a budget to do a study or an analysis, the ministries under their control ponied up.
So in Jokowi's situation, he's pressed by time. He has made promises to the nation. He needs to now demonstrate that he's a capable leader of a country as opposed to a mayor of a city. At the same time, there's no support infrastructure to allow him to deliver. So this is creating some political issues.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, he'll say something, but you know, in democracies, you always need that guy walking around with the clipboard saying, did this guy do this? Did that guy do that? Essentially, in Indonesia, there is no guy with a clipboard. So let's say he'll make a speech. Oh, we need a lot more foreign investment because we have to build a lot of infrastructure, say. And then his Minister of State Enterprises might say, you know, I think state enterprises should build all the roads, right, and crowd out the private. And there's nobody who says, well, actually, both of those things can't be true. right? There's no arbiter to that.
Yeah. So it stalls.
So it stalls.
Yeah.
So it stalls. Or, you know, you've got, and then you've got a whole set of, so you have a whole bunch of siloed behavior in the executive branch, okay? Which is, let's call that problem one. Problem two is you've got a legislature, which essentially you've got, I mean, it may seem like a long time, 18, 19 years, but in the history of political evolution, it's not. So you've got these political parties that basically have no platforms. They don't really have a set of issues. They're still run by the party bosses that were around when Suharto was around. And it's still kind of a Tammany Hall type scene, you know, where it's just the party bosses giving out and very corrupt and, you know, requiring the executive branch to bribe the parliament just to pass laws, for example. It really is at that level. So for Jokowi, trying to get a parliament to pass more sensible laws is a very difficult thing, even though nominally most of the political parties say they support him. But, you know, what they really support is a system that allows them to make a lot of money.
So the question then is, democracy succeeding, or was Indonesia, given its fabric, its constitution, basically more inclined towards success under a more of a authoritarian regime?
Well, in an ideal world, you know, you would say you should try to do this in stages. You should try to walk before you run. But of course, in the real world, that rarely ever happens. You know, the pressure builds up on the authoritarian to the point where there's always a bit of an explosion. And then to avoid a recoil to authoritarianism, the pendulum tends to swing way the other way when we become very democratic or very decentralized. But you're doing so in an environment where there are really very few functioning institutions. It becomes very, very hard to govern that way. And then because you don't govern successfully, then you start to feel pressures for the pendulum to come back the other way. And then you start to say, you know, we need more of strongman rule. We need to take away powers. And indeed, even in today, in the 2014 election that Jokowi won narrowly, his opponent, that's essentially was his platform. We need a little bit more of Suharto, right? We need a little bit more of a strongman rule, because this full-fledged Western one man, one vote democracy clearly isn't working. We're paying an enormous inefficiency premium, or I don't know if that's the right way to put it, a discount maybe, for this form of government. And by the way, as we look around the neighborhood, we look at non-democratic governments, China, Vietnam, Singapore, others, they're doing a lot better than us. Mm. They're growing faster. They're making decisions faster. They're getting more investment. Mm. Foreign investors, you know, despite what their foreign investors' governments might say about democracy and human rights, the foreign investors themselves clearly prefer to go to places where decisions get made faster and quicker and more efficiently.
And where there's an element of authoritarianism.
And often those attributes come where there's a degree of authoritarianism.
So here we are again at another critical crossroads for Indonesia. And as a longtime Indonesia watcher, what would be your predictions in the next 3 to 5 years, Adam?
I think we're at a bit of an inflection point. Listen, like I was mentioning earlier, because of the very long time that Indonesians lived under an authoritarian, colonial, non-democratic regime, there is still a lot of sensation or a lot of feeling that we don't want to give up those liberties that come with democracy. But that said, at the end of the day, you know, in most democracies, and Indonesia is no exception, people do tend to vote pocketbook issues. And Indonesia Indonesia is growing at 5%, which isn't bad in today's world. But frankly, it should be growing a lot faster. It's got all the intrinsics to grow a lot faster. It's got, it's in a great neighborhood for one. It's got great natural riches. Demographics are on its favor. Half the population is under the age of 30. But it's not getting the investment it needs. And that's for the whole, you know, a whole bunch of reasons for that, many of them self-inflicted. And eventually, 5% growth isn't going to do it for Indonesia when you've got 2 to 3 million new Indonesians entering the workforce every year. You've got a an inadequate educational system. There isn't a single world-class university in the country. Very hard to move up the skill ladder if you don't have skilled labor. And very hard to get jobs for the estimated 30, 40 million underemployed Indonesians if you can't provide the environment for those sorts of investors to come in. So stable minimum wages, stable utilities, you know, no corruption at the ports, that kind of stuff, which to date, Indonesia still hasn't been able to deliver. So I would put myself in the camp of Indonesia still has some time to kind of pull itself out of this rut. I think Jokowi's got very good instincts on what's needed. The question really is, it's more a systemic one. Can he fix the system, the institutions, fast enough so that he's able to govern effectively in a democratic way?
I'm Steve Stein, and that was my discussion with Adam Schwarz, founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors. Actually, it was the first part of our conversation. As you can probably tell, we're just getting started. We focus this episode on Indonesia and its experiments with democracy. In the next episode, we're going to broaden the discussion and look at democratic movements across Asia Pacific. In particular, we're going to consider the impact the Trump administration may be having on the evolution or devolution of democracy in the region. It's a fascinating discussion. You can find it, along with our other episodes, at InsideAsiaPodcast.com. And please join the conversation. Leave us a review on iTunes and give us your perspective on the situation in Indonesia. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia.